Strengthen your immune system with Goldman Laboratories liposomal vitamin C and get 10% off. Quote 10 off at goldmanlaboratories.com.
Welcome, everyone. This is Aisha Sherzai and Dean Sherzai, your host for the Brain Health and Beyond show. We're glad to be here again with an exciting episode. Today, Dean and I decided to talk to you guys about our book. We wrote a book which was released in September of 2017 in the U.S. The title is The Alzheimer's Solution, a breakthrough program to prevent and reverse the symptoms of cognitive decline at every age. And it's essentially a culmination of our work in the realm of brain health for the past 16 years, I'd say.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is this was kind of courageous of us to kind of undertake, because to write a book in the middle of a full clinical practice, in the middle of a full research practice, is not a simple undertaking. And then to believe that out of thousands of neurologists, your book is going to be the one that's going to be picked by one of the publishers is almost psychotic in many ways, or at least delusional. But no, we believed in what we had done. We believed in what we had seen, and we believed in our research and our journey and our the risks we took to get where we were. We ended up in doing research in prevention and looking at prevention, which is something people don't do. The people have written about books about Alzheimer's and prevention, but almost none of them have done true research, on prevention. If they've done something to that effect, it's been on 5, 6, 10 people, and that's basically it. Whereas for us, it was our entire work was around prevention. We coined the term preventive neurology. So actually before even going to Loma Linda in 2007, you and I had the first conversation and started writing the manuscript and writing some of the background and looking at some of the people that had done some lifestyle work, such as Dan Buettner and Colin Campbell and others, and looking at the data. And it was then that we decided to take the crazy leap of not going to the traditional path and going towards preventive medicine.
Yes, yes, I recall those days very clearly. And there were exciting times, and it was scary too for me because, to take the responsibility and the undertaking of undertaking an incredible work of being able to present the evidence so far on brain health in a convincing way, but, holding yourself to a very high standard of not messing the data and to, making it palatable to everybody, but yet keeping the scientific integrity. And I thought it was going to be a tough job. And I remember the conversation you and I used to have. I had a tremendous amount of trepidation moving forward, but it made sense in many ways because this was essentially our understanding of the bigger picture.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad we did it, but it took a lot of work.
Exactly. I mean, 10 years of writing and collecting and doing research and looking outside of, data, looking at patterns, shaping your clinical practice towards understanding lifestyle and prevention. Just to give you an idea of how difficult that is, you get paid by the number of people you see in the clinic. One gets paid by seeing, more patients, obviously. So if you see a patient every 10 minutes, you get paid more. We actually spent more time with the patients, collected data, information, and even our notes were collection of data. I mean, and then we went to the communities. Remember all the talks in the churches?
Yes.
My PhD data was based on community perceptions as far as the chronic disease of aging is concerned.
Right.
And so it was kind of out of the box. It was complex, but we were able to then finally in 2015 bring all the papers together into a manuscript. The manuscript had been written a while ago, but cleaned it over and over and over again, collected more data. And we presented it to the publishers, and lo and behold, the first group that saw it said they loved it.
I was in tears that day.
We got their support, and we started. But the irony was, when we first wrote it, it was so scientifically oriented. Well, the language was not. I mean, the content was not. Well, had a lot of science. We had 300 publications that we cited. But more important than that, the language was not simplistic. It was science talk.
Very, at times esoteric.
Esoteric. It took us how many? 7 rewrites?
A little over that.
Yes, and we had...
I lost count afterwards.
And we had help from a couple of people, Dr. Howard Rankin and Amy Shaloon and others who were great writers to kind of guide us and support us. They're brilliant, brilliant people. And many others, actually.
Of course.
And the publishers themselves that, in a very nice way, would say... this needs to be rewritten. And it took us a while. And then in 2017, we decided to come back from Cedars to Loma Linda. And we had 3 months to travel the world in the interim.
Yeah, that was the only time that we thought we would have the time with the kids to enjoy ourselves.
When do two neurologists, husband and wife, have 3 months to themselves?
Unheard of.
So we had the entire plan. We're going to go drive around the country and then take a voyage to Alaska, then take the train through Alaska, then come back and then fly to Europe and do the same thing throughout Europe.
And what happened?
And then on the way, right outside of California, in Arizona, we get a call saying, the timelines have been moved up.
And that was our publisher.
Yes. And we need it much quicker, and we need you guys to start working on it and get it out.
So we drove to Las Vegas, and we chose a hotel there so that the kids could swim and have a good time. Well, you and I would sit long hours in the cafe, even though it was closed late at night, while we would hear people playing cards and other games. And we finished writing the book there.
Obi was with us. Our dog, Obi-Wan Kenobi. We call him Obi. He was there in the hotel. What a great hotel that would let dogs,
They were very friendly.
Incredible. Yes. In fact, I remember the first time when Obi, we took him out. And we had to take him through the gauntlet, through all the slot machines and everything. He got nervous. Obi is a rescue dog.
Yes.
He was not treated well as a baby. And he had significant anxiety attacks. And whenever he had a lot of people around him, he would relieve himself. He had no couth. He would just relieve himself and anywhere. And they were so nice. They just put things around us and they cleaned the place. And they said, we're used to this. Don't worry. And we really appreciated that. But at nights, throughout the day, we were next to the pool writing. And then at nights, the kids would be asleep. We would be downstairs next to cafes. Nobody around, and except the gamblers, and I don't think we ever gambled.
No.
Yeah, and then
I'm not good at it anyway.
Yeah, I don't think anybody is, but nonetheless, we finished a book, and there it was, and we submitted it, and the timelines were set, and it was absolutely amazing.
It was
the feeling. We've done many research papers,
right?
I mean, even really foreboding and huge papers like comprehensive reviews and meta-analyses, which are, there are beasts. There are difficult research projects and huge clinical trials, but nothing like this. This was a challenge.
It was. I agree. The day that we got it done and we sent it to the publisher, that excited feeling. And then remember when you first got the first copy of our book, it was probably around beginning of September. And so the book became available to the public on the 17th. And so far...
2017.
That's right, 2017. And so far it's been translated into 7 languages.
I thought it was more than that. But in any case, lots of languages. Right. I think Spanish,
German, Portuguese, Chinese, Korean,
Hebrew.
Am I forgetting someone? Yeah. Do we count English too?
Yeah, no. I mean, British English. Yeah, we had to write published. A whole thing. On, yeah, that was interesting.
Yes, I think I'm forgetting a language, but what an exciting time.
And then we set up all this pre-sale system where we had to talk on radios. We spoke on, I think, nearly 60 radio stations.
Yes, it was 64 to be exact.
And since we were in West Coast, a lot of them would be like at 5 o'clock in our time.
Oh, yeah. We've given a lot of radio show talks in our pajamas.
Yes.
And just reaching out and talking about the book and explaining what it was all about and getting all the love and the emails. And that was exciting.
One of the things we did was because the international book was bought by Simon & Schuster.
Right.
And they invited us to UK, to London, to be specific. And we flew to London, and we were supposed to talk on BBC Breakfast.
Yes.
The largest show in the world, seen by most people, heard by most people throughout the world. And we were excited. 45 minutes on BBC Breakfast? Are you kidding? That's bigger than, you know, any other program in the world. We got there. We came to London. And the BBC complex is actually almost like a city.
Yes.
And so, yeah, we had to get the train and go there. I think Glasgow, in any case.
It was a city, I forget the name.
Yeah, and we landed, and as we're in the train going towards the show, we get a call, and one of the publishers or one of the assistants was with us and saying that the equivalent of Alzheimer's Association in UK had called them saying that this is too controversial. Lifestyle and its effect on brain is too controversial. Can you believe that?
They said that there's not much evidence to support that.
Yes, which means that they had not read a single paper.
Hilarious.
It was
I don't think anybody had read the book.
Yeah. So we were told that the segment had been cut from 45 minutes to 15 minutes. Actually, it was shorter than that. And we were kind of disappointed. Alex and Sophie were with us, and we were kind of down. And the one saving grace was that they had booked ABBA, we love ABBA, there, and they were there. We met them and took pictures, and it was wonderful. But it was very cold conversation because they had been primed. And what's funny is the same organizations are now doing lifestyle research.
Right.
And they won't. And yet, well, that tells you how sometimes, no matter how big the organizations, they are not on top of the data.
That's right.
And because they're focused on their little myopic world.
And I think you and I see that in several different areas as well, where everybody's trying their best to protect the past or the set path. It's easy. It's what everybody has been doing. And any deviation causes a bit of a chaos.
It's actually a neurological thing. Change is discomfort. Status quo is lower energy cognitive state. And any change, anything from the past towards the future, it creates significant dissonance in the brain. And it recognizes it's going to be high energy state. I'm going to have to go from the normal automatic pathways of habit to cortical thinking and then the yield. You know the past. The devil you know is better than the devil
right,
you know.
Right.
And in the future, there's a whole spectrum of possibilities, many of them failures potentially, plus the fact that you have to expand energy. So there's always a resistance to the future, to the change.
Right.
And that's okay. Understanding that will give us a better understanding of how to make change in the world. Because you and I believe that everything else is just managing the present. Leadership is in being comfortable with this discomfort, with discomfort of looking ahead. And so we got on a tangent, and you'll get a lot of that with our conversations because we are passionate and we love these thoughts. And so we were disheartened. We came back and came back to U.S. And now 2 years later, the main speech, the main talk in Alzheimer's Association International Conference was prevention is the new cure.
Right. Remember when we came back, we went to the Alzheimer's Association International Conference. And thousands of people sitting there at the plenary session. And the first, you and I presented, and the first presentation was by Mia Kivipalto. She's the PI or the principal investigator of the FINGER study, the Finnish Geriatric Study. Huge study that looks at the effect of lifestyle and cognitive status and cognitive decline, and the results were amazing. It showed that lifestyle matters. It slowed down cognitive decline, and it actually protected from Alzheimer's disease. And I remember clearly the slide that came on that said, prevention is the new treatment.
5,000 people watching that.
Right. And there was almost a standing ovation for her.
It was, absolutely.
And that was, you know, you and I looked at each other just gently and remember the time when we were, you know, almost ostracized from that whole community of brain health because, but it was also exciting to know, like, well, there it is. You know, everybody's now on board with the importance of prevention and lifestyle.
Yeah, and we never, again, we never said that traditional medicine doesn't work, because it does. We never said that Western medicine or Eastern medicine or this medicine or alternative medicine. We said that there's medicine that's for sick care, which is incredibly important. And then there's preventive medicine that the system does not focus on at all. We're never trained for it. You know, 4 years of college, 4 years of medical school, 4 years of 5 years of residency or more, fellowships. And after 15, 17, 20 years of education, all you've learned is pills and knife, which is great, wonderful. They saved my life when they did surgery, the neurosurgeons at Georgetown, and we have, you know, medicine, our medicine. We're physicians,
right?
MDs, and we has helped so many people as far as infections are concerned.
Of course.
But when it comes to prevention, nowhere do we get trained properly, or at all for that matter, in a lot of places, as far as prevention is concerned. And the system, as far as monetization of the system, is not supportive of it. And it's time to change. Now, there's a complexity to that. Prevention is not with one pill.
Right.
It's not one vitamin or any vitamins. It's not with, when, you know, some magic process. It's more complex at multiple levels. It has to be at the home and the community, which means it brings this dissonance in people's minds, like, what do we do? How do we do this? Especially public health, especially financial systems that support healthcare. How do we do this? Well, we're learning more, and we're part of this conversation. We're actually in the lead of one of the biggest projects in the country, in U.S., on prevention and community brain health.
Right.
And as we learn more, and with the help of technology, that will become simpler and more effective. And overnight, our system will change from a sick care model, hopefully, to a healthcare model.
It's exciting. And that's what we hoped to convey, and we did convey in our book. When we wrote it, we wanted people to know that you have to have a multifaceted approach to brain health.
Yes.
It's not one thing. Obviously, it has to be personalized, which means that every individual starts their journey towards brain health at their own point, you know, and they have to determine what the next step is. They have to determine what their areas of weaknesses are and what the positive or the strengths are.
You're giving some of the book away there. That's
Am
good.
I?
No,
yeah.
no, that, that's yeah. good. That's absolutely right. The book has a lot of science, but you're not going to get overwhelmed by science at all, because it's interspersed and it's story format. We also have personal stories in the book. We talk about myths as well, because if we don't talk about how the science works and what myths are out there, we will, you know, you will get lost. All of us will get lost. We had in the past gotten lost. So some of the myths that we quickly addressed in the book was the fact that Alzheimer's, and for that matter, many brain diseases, cannot be affected
right.
because they're genetic diseases.
Yeah.
And that couldn't be further from the truth.
Right.
Brain diseases can be affected outside of just medicine. Brain diseases can be prevented. They can be influenced. They can be treated. So that's the first myth. The second myth is that's a genetic disease. Well, everything's a genetic
process. Yeah, we hear that all the time.
Yeah.
My mom had Alzheimer's. I think I'm having Alzheimer's now. Or
not you. You're saying some patients.
Well, yeah, I'm just giving an example of somebody coming into our clinic with that statement. I mean, I hear that over and over and over again. Completely normal people coming in because one of their loved ones had Alzheimer's or dementia, and now they're scared that they're going to develop it. And the way we explain it is, you know, yes, you know, every disease is genetic, But Alzheimer's and dementias are polygenetic, which means there are multiple genes that are involved in manifestation of the disease. It's not one only.
Yeah, it's a range. And each of those genes give you a different range of risk.
And there are only a handful of genes that, you know, push you towards the precipice to develop disease.
Yeah.
And the percentage of Alzheimer's disease patients that have those genes is only 3%.
Correct. I mean, the different genes have different effect, different push as far as the disease. So the three genes that if you have these genes, you're most likely going to get the disease no matter what happens. This is presenilin-1, presenilin-2, and APP. And people who have those genes, any one of those genes, they will get the disease early in life.
APP stands for amyloid precursor protein.
Protein, yeah. And you see APP, we're talking about Down syndrome. Patients, individuals that have Down syndrome, almost all of them start developing symptoms and even signs of disease early on in their 40s and earlier. And then almost everybody, if they live long enough, they'll develop Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
Now, the other 97% have other genes. So it's not one gene. We've identified more than 20 genes that have been associated with Alzheimer's. Some of them have higher risk. Some of them have lower risk. One of the ones that, besides those three, that has higher risk that a lot of people in the audience might have heard of is APOE4. So APOE4 is part of a family of genes, APOE2, APOE3, APOE4, and others, that have to do with lipid transport, fat transport.
And between cell to cell.
So if you have APOE2, you have really good genes.
Your body can metabolize fat very well.
Very efficiently. And people who have APOE2 have very low risk of Alzheimer's, meaning that they have to do really bad things in order to develop Alzheimer's. I gave a clue there. So APOE3 is a wash. APOE4, though, people who have APOE4, one gene from one parent, their risk goes up 4 times. If they have both parents that gave them the gene, first of all, you know, you have to realize that risk goes up significantly, up to 20 times. But even in that population, those that have two genes, 50% never developed the disease. Mm. So what happened? Lifestyle. And then what about the other genes that have lower risk, but they confer risk? You know, those genes are not Alzheimer's genes. Those are genes that have to do with your vascular response during times of trauma. Your immune response, that's a big category. Or garbage disposal, meaning genes that have to do with your body's ability to get rid of waste. Remember, this brain is overwhelmed. It's processing all the time. It's metabolizing all the time. It has to clean up. It has to get rid of waste and all. So if it doesn't have good genes for that, it's going to be overwhelmed quickly. So if you have those genes, they give you a range of risk, meaning anywhere from 10 to 40 years, depending on where you are in age. And whether you will manifest or not depends on if you overwhelm those genes. So let's say your lipid metabolism. So if let's say you have a bad gene for lipid metabolism, which also is involved in inflammation. So what if you ate a diet that had really low inflammatory markers or inflammation and really did not, you had low cholesterol levels, and had low inflammation levels, and you did other things that lowered inflammation, like good sleep and, you know, all of that other stuff that we'll talk about. Well, even with bad genes, you'll not develop the disease. That's where genes are. Somebody, I think, said that, you know, genes are like, they load the gun, lifestyle pulls the trigger.
Right.
I don't like that analogy because it's too sudden. Lifestyle is, you're going up a ramp. That's your gene.
Yeah.
And how steep it is determined by your gene. And whether you're going to go down this ramp or not is the resistance that your lifestyle confers against
right,
that.
Right.
So, but the gun analogy is a lot more visual. So I guess it will stand.
Became famous.
Popular. So nonetheless, that's where the genes are. So there's a lot of other myths as well. But these two myths we wanted to kind of bring up. And for decades, we have spent money in the wrong place.
Right.
Decades. And another reason we wanted to, you know, bring out the book to kind of get the audience to become advocates to redirecting the money from this molecular research there are two proteins that were found to be abnormal in Alzheimer's patients. Very early. In fact, even when Eloise Alzheimer's, the physician that actually identified the disease first, knew that there was amyloid in the brains of patients who had this. That's 100 years ago.
Yeah.
And we've been trying to block this amyloid and you know, destroy it and never let it develop. And hundreds of millions of dollars later, we are still have zero cures, zero. The medicines we have are only symptomatic, meaning they don't slow the disease down. Not even the pharmaceutical companies claim that. But they affect the symptoms for a few years. But as far as treatment or disease modification, zero. Why? Because we think that they're focusing on the wrong thing. Amyloid is involved, but we think it's downstream, not upstream. And there's so much more to it, and it's a more complex approach that we have to address instead of just focusing on one molecule.
Right.
In fact, recently, another drug just failed.
Yeah.
Biogen drug.
Yeah, and Pfizer, the pharmaceutical company, completely withdrew its efforts to study Alzheimer's altogether. Isn't that incredible?
It is.
Like when a pharmaceutical company completely gives up in an area because they know that, you know, the billions of dollars that they spent looking at molecular research or animal research was for none, nothing. And I think people are realizing that it's something else, and you have to look at the bigger picture.
And it's such a waste. All these years have been wasted. We're not against molecular research. We did molecular research.
But it has served us really well in other areas.
Yes, it has. And incredible. But we have to have some other avenues as well, more complex. And it's so important because in UK, it's the number one cause of mortality and morbidity. In Japan, number one cause. In US, it's number three cause. And it's climbing in US. In fact, in US, it's the costliest disease. In fact, in most countries, it's the costliest disease of them all. The second costliest disease in America is heart disease at $120 billionaires or so.
Right.
Third is all cancers combined at $60 to $70 billion. Alzheimer's, direct cost alone is $259 billion. Indirect cost, another $200-something billion. And these numbers are climbing fast. In fact, as we're doing better and better as far as surviving diseases, the number of diseases are not reducing, you know, but we're surviving them better. But when it comes to Alzheimer's, in the last 15 years, mortality has risen by 145%.
Right.
And that number is going to grow much more. In fact, the cost in the U.S. alone is expected to be above $1.1 to $2 trillion, which means by itself it will collapse our healthcare system. Same thing in U.K., same thing in all Western countries. And ironically, even countries like China and Japan, China and India, which had done well with these chronic diseases because their diet was not processed, did not have a lot of these fatty foods and sugary foods. Now with what we call the affluence paradox, they are doing worse when it comes to chronic diseases.
Yeah, they're becoming more westernized.
It is, and that's where the problem is. So we see a sense of urgency. This conversation we're having is not just a conversation of information, but basically getting advocates on board, getting people to join the effort to get things moving.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the book, I think the section on myth and misunderstanding is just that, to make people aware of some of the noise and the clutter out there that stops people from actually looking into this disease in a very positive way, in a constructive way. People feel doomed when they talk about Alzheimer's disease as if, you know, okay, we have a few years, let's enjoy it, and then we're going to get it, and there's nothing that anyone can do. And that's not true at all.
This book is a very actionable book, meaning that you can actually take it and start changing your life. But there are some sections that we thought was absolutely necessary to kind of help you traverse this landscape of noise. There's so much noise out there that we wanted to kind of provide the data and the thinking process of how to cut through the myths and the fallacies.
Right.
I mean, you know how many diets are out there now. And all of them are false because they're just trying to pick off people around their confirmation bias, around what they want to hear.
Right.
But they're incredibly unhealthy from keto to paleo to all of these, which we will get into in the future.
Yeah,
in detail.
I think we should have several conversations about diet alone, because I think it's one of the most modifiable risk factors for Alzheimer's disease and dementia, for brain health in general. And the insane amount of false information out there is just absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah.
And so we can have a conversation about it. But yeah, we've known for decades and decades what kind of diet works. It's usually plants. You know, fats are not bad. It's the type of fat that you consume.
In fact, we don't even believe in the word diet. It's a lifestyle.
Yes.
And we don't believe in focusing on, you know, the superfood or the nutraceutical or the vitamin. We believe in focusing on eating patterns.
Right.
And creating a life around those eating patterns, right, which will have the much more profound effect. So from our research and all the reviews we did, five areas came out to be most important for brain health.
Right. And we created an acronym for it, NEURO, self-serving, because of neurologists.
Yes.
You know, you came up with it, Dana. It's a great acronym. So NEURO, N stands for nutrition, E stands for exercise, U stands for unwind or stress management, R stands for restorative sleep, and O stands for optimization of cognitive activity in the context of social activity.
One part of this that's actually even more important than all of that is we're neurobehaviorists as well. So how do you – just throwing information at people doesn't mean that that's going to happen. I mean, we know all these New Year resolutions, all these diet patterns, but how do you make it habit? So this book actually gives you a workbook of how do you inculcate this and make it part of your life.
And I think that's one of the things that sets us apart from other programs, or I don't even like using the word protocol. But programs is, you know, there's a lot of information out there, but rarely do people focus on how to inculcate that into public health and into populations. You can't just prescribe a particular lifestyle and allow the person to understand it and then copy it. Failures after failures have happened because nobody's addressed the importance of the behavioral perspective of lifestyle.
Correct. I mean, so with that said, we will get into the areas a little bit, realizing that we're going to just give you the science and how you apply it to your life. Well, you have to read it in the book and you'll see.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so nutrition, both Aisha and I, we're very, very interested in nutrition. And in fact, our higher degrees are in nutrition. And but Aisha's done some amazing work in California Teacher Study and many others that we'll have an entire different section on that, because
right,
that study probably is groundbreaking. So, but I'll let you speak about the nutrition component.
Yeah, so, you know, nutrition is probably the most important environmental exposure. You know, this is something that we're exposed to every single day, several times a day. And now we know that every food and every decision we make about what we put in our body either makes the brain or breaks the brain. Why? Because that's the raw fuel, the building blocks that you introduce into your body. And unfortunately, we live at a day and age where the fast-paced life has stopped people from really making better decisions. And with fast foods being available and everything being ultra-processed, it's very easy to consume unhealthy nutrients. But even, you know, more than focusing on just nutrients, I think it's important for us to understand food. We don't need vitamins or nutrients. We eat food.
Exactly. And one other element is that it's not just a passive presence of bad food. There's an active process of getting people addicted to bad food.
Right.
I mean, the producers are brilliant. They know what foods have addictive capacity. And our evolution has made us addictive to certain foods because of survival. But the system has, or the food system has perfected it. Knowing that this amount of fat and this amount of sugar will make this person completely addicted. So it's not even just a passive presence. and being busy. Now, it's an active process of being addicted to processed and certain types of food, true. Which makes it so dangerous.
True, absolutely.
And that's why it's not because we're eating less meat. No, we're not. The foods, we're eating more bad foods. I mean, the studies from CDC and other places that are coming that we're actually eating more and more and more. You know, when it comes to our appetite, it's not a zero-sum economics. We just keep, you know, pushing the barriers of eating.
And that's why obesity is such a big problem in the world, especially in the United States. And as a result, everybody's looking for a diet, you know. Again, a quick fix, a diet to lose weight, a diet for brain cleanse and all the other terminologies that they use.
Biohacking, brain hacking, all these terms that...
Which has no basis in science and is just a marketing scam. Looking at these different diets, they either cut out a major food group or, you know, take more of a food group that is unhealthy to begin with. This nonsense about, you know, paleo diet and how our forefathers and our ancestors ate. Well, by the way, paleo diet is not just one diet. You know, in the Paleolithic era, there were multiple variants of the paleo diet. So which one are we supposed to follow?
And who says that what they say was paleo? Because the feces and bone data shows otherwise.
Right. And it's just a flawed, it's a flawed mechanism. And, you know, also... It makes me almost laugh when I hear that, you know, they state that our ancestors in the Paleolithic era had better health. Well, when the average age is 33, how can you equate that,
yes,
that particular lifestyle to how we are right now, where, you know, what is the average age? In the United States, it's, you know, close 40. To the, something like that.
Yeah.
We live up to age 83.
Yes.
I mean, that's the average age of longevity in the United States.
Yeah.
So that pattern can't be applied to what we're doing today.
Correct.
We have to go by the norms and the patterns today. And, you know, data after data after data for the past 80 years, no matter where it comes from, whatever, you know, what university, what part of the world, it shows that when people eat an unprocessed, mostly plant-based diet, they tend to do better. Their brain health is better. Their cardiac health is better. They live longer. And they actually are more productive as human beings.
Yeah. I mean, we'll get into the specifics of nutrition and the studies at another time, completely focused on diet. But there are many, many, many studies, including our own reviews that you can look at, and PubMed and other peer-reviewed journals, sources that shows the data, and it centers around plant-based eating, and especially non-processed. Now, when we say that, it doesn't mean that everybody should just jump to that. We say that that's the fact. Your journey is not that.
Right.
Your journey is your next best step.
Exactly.
That's the only way we can create success. Otherwise, we're just throwing an unachievable goal for people, and then then what we do is we fail, and then we create language to the alternative.
Right.
Like words like my second least favorite word, moderation. As soon as somebody wants to get out of a diet or a lifestyle or some change, everything's about moderation. Well, I used to eat meat 7 times a day when I was in Pittsburgh. Moderation for me would have meant 5 times. Is that any better? Moderation does not have a denominator. It's not well circumscribed. We'll talk about that as well. So the next area was E, exercise.
Right.
And you'll be surprised. It's not just about, you just have to exercise. It's a lot more than that. Exercise is probably, as far as frailty and vitality of aging, the most important factor. In fact, when it comes to vital aging and resilience, exercise is critical. But it's not just walking the neighborhood or gardening or, you know, in my patients, I bring up exercise. Oh, don't worry about exercise. I do. I walk at work all the time. And, you know, I garden all the time. Well, that's great. That's meditation. And there might be some physicality to that. But we're talking about serious exercise, you know, where you get, you know, break a sweat. You get tired every day, at least 5 days a week, up to 25 to 30 minutes. So whatever that is, be it a brisk walk, which several studies have come in our book, we've cited multiple of them. In fact, even since the book, some big studies from Harvard came that showed that even a brisk walk, 20 minutes a day, reduced your chance of Alzheimer's even by as much as 40%. And then the second thing is, even if you exercise half an hour a day, but then you sit around, you negated the benefit.
Right.
If you sat around for 8 hours recumbent, you've negated the benefit. So move around throughout the day. Get up every hour, stretch, do squats, you know, whatever you need to just keep moving. And that's the third element comes to that, the legs. If you're going to do any aerobic exercise, and all of it is good, which is weightlifting and, you know, and proper amounts, depending on your age, your, you know, injuries and all that. But the most important one so far seems to be leg strength.
Right.
By the way, so far, you're going to hear that a lot. We are okay with the knowledge that we have today. We don't need absolute certainty. So, so far, the data shows that leg strength is associated with brain health.
Right.
So build those legs, and not just for that. One of the things that as we get older that gets us to the hospital is fall risk.
Exactly.
There's nothing better for abatement or stopping or avoiding fall risk than leg strength. So that's leg strength.
Yeah.
And then thirdly, it's stress management. We'll do an entire section on that, which is not just reducing stress, but
increasing good stress. So I think that's one of my favorite conversations, where the balance of bad and good stress is clarified. I think one of the best things we can do is to be aware of what the good stress elements are and what the bad stress elements are in our lives. Bad stress is the type of stress we don't have any control over, but good stress is that cognitive challenge that we always talk about. And if bad stress is not reduced, it literally shrinks the brain.
Absolutely.
And there's so much data to explain and to clarify that. And R is for sleep, restorative sleep.
Yeah, it's not just sleeping. It's just not just being knocked out with some medicines. If you're not getting deep, we're talking about deep with the EEG changes that go to the, and we'll talk about the specific types of EEG changes that you want to achieve. If you don't go into deep sleep, you're not restoring. And my gosh, restoring the brain during sleep is critical.
Yeah.
That's where most of the cleansing takes place. Studies have shown, and you'll read in the book, that even one night's bad sleep means increased inflammation, oxidation, even amyloid deposition, the protein that we were talking about. So working on good sleep hygiene, good sleep environment is your ultimate goal. Don't go into a spa. Don't spend money on some retreat. Spend it on a great sleep environment in your home and learn about it. That's about sleep hygiene, about cognitive behavioral therapy and all of these things. And we'll talk about that, and we will talk with some great, great scientists that are the leading figures in sleep.
Speaking of learning, it brings us to the last element of optimize or cognitive activity, lifelong learning and keeping our minds active. You always say this is the most important aspect of brain health.
It is. I mean, it has to do with neuronal connections. Now, we have 87 billion neurons. Each of them can make a few connections. I'm generalizing. It's a little more complex than that. But they can also make as many as 30,000 connections.
Hmm.
Imagine that. That's an exponential growth that we have control over at any time, at any age. And that takes place through good stress. Remember, when you're learning something, it's not without stress. You're supposed to push yourself to learn. That's good stress. Where people that were most highly protected were people who are high-level executives that, you know, did all the education, had the kind of, you know, the kind of stress with a purpose, with direction, with timelines. That was the highest level of protection. Now, you have to learn throughout life. And if one learns throughout life, it protects against anything. We will talk about the nun study, where nuns that had, you know, smaller brains after autopsy, after they died, and with amyloid deposition, yet they were normal. When they looked at their writings, and they looked at, you know, how they had lived their lives, it was a complexity, and learning, lifelong learning. So lifelong learning and complexity of language that they had developed was protective even in the face of Alzheimer's and pathology. That's amazing.
Another great example is, because we're on the UK radio,
yes,
is the London taxi driver study. And I'm pretty sure that a lot of people are aware of that. But, apparently back in the 1950s, I believe, London taxi drivers had to go through this gruesome test to get their license to be able to drive around the city. And obviously the city map is not as easy as it is in New York City. And some scientists were interested in looking at their brain health before and after this particular test.
Well, it's more complex because London is gorgeous.
Absolutely.
I mean, I know you're a big fan of New York, but I love London.
I love New York, but I absolutely fell in love with London when we were there. And the results were incredible.
The taxi drivers, we're talking, as Aisha said, these are people in their 50s and older. Before and after the test, the before and after the learning. This is just a few months of learning. Their brains were larger, specifically the hippocampus, the part of the brain that deals with memory and learning. And they had better cognitive function. So at a later age in life, putting yourself through that kind of a challenge changed the infrastructure of the brain. It actually made it grow. Remember, this is in the context of a brain that continues to shrink as after the age of 20, and cognitive activity actually made it grow. That's remarkable. So you just got a taste of the book and the concept. And by the way, we're starting another book, which will be coming out in about 6 to 8 months, which is more food-centered. But this book of ours, Alzheimer's Solution, is fantastic because all the profits also go to our foundation, Healthy Minds Initiative, where we're hoping to go to communities and raise awareness. That's how Aisha and I started our life, is through service, and it's continuing.
And that's basically it for today. Thank you so much for joining us. It was wonderful to share this information with you. You can find us on social media as Team Shares Eye, and our website is teamsharesi.com. And you can learn more about our efforts about the Healthy Minds Initiative on healthymindsinitiative.org. And with that, we bid you well. Until next time, live an unforgettable life.
Thank you.